Oh, yeah, you're applauding now, but after we get into this topic, you might be saying, Joe, what is there to cheer all about? Because now you're talking about shame. I don't want to feel shame, and I don't blame you. Now, in the last podcast, we talked about guilt and a little bit about the differences between guilt and shame. But I want to talk more about shame now, because shame is not really well understood. Shame actually can express itself differently through depression, anxiety. Because of shame, you can develop overeating. There's a lot of problems with shame. But I want to go into it and where it comes from and how to move beyond it. But that, by the way, is the tricky part. How do you move beyond shame? And you do want to move beyond it, because it is a destructive force probably causing you misery. And shame can shape every aspect of your life, including how you see yourself as unworthy of love, joy, a sense of accomplishment, and nearly any of the good things that God and life offer you. So a simple test, again, of whether you're feeling appropriate guilt or bogged down with shame is this. It is guilt if you've done wrong, feel bad about it, and use it as a motivation to change and do good. And then you feel better. And the last part about feeling better, that's key. Because if you feel bad no matter what you do, then it's probably shame. So where did you pick up this darkness? And how can you experience the shift change required to love, to be loved, and feel appropriately good about yourself? Now, at the risk of sounding psychobabbly, let's talk about your childhood and earlier. It's pretty common knowledge that a baby in the womb is affected by their mother's eating habits, nutrition, responses to stress, etc. While in the womb, you enjoyed about 9 months of touch. Nice. But what happens immediately after birth can be another story. So skin-to-skin contact between mother and child in the first hour after delivery helps to regulate the baby's temperature, heart rate, and breathing, and helps them cry less. It also increases the mother's relaxation hormones. In other words, our relationship quality matters from the very beginning. Touch is that first sense to develop, and babies use it to begin understanding their bodies and the world. As reported in Scientific American, by ages 6 to 12, levels of the stress hormone cortisol were still much higher in children who had lived in orphanages more than 8 months than in those who were adopted at or before the age of 4 months, according to the study from the Development and Psychopathology. But you didn't have to grow up in an orphanage to experience deprivation. All along your early life's journey, you took in the information, and your brain, either correctly or sometimes incorrectly, formed an opinion about yourself and the world in which you live. Did your caretaker respond to you when you became afraid? If not, you may have learned that your feelings don't matter. Did your dad congratulate you when you first managed to get some peas into your mouth instead of your hair? If not, you may have begun to believe that your accomplishments don't matter. Were you given adequate food when you were hungry? If not, you may think that your bodies and your needs don't count. I don't matter becomes the internal set point. Shame. Both good and bad memories last into adulthood if connected with powerful childhood emotions. So if there are no strong emotions, events tend to be forgotten. But if coupled with high emotions, either good or bad, they are more likely to be remembered and influential. So not all negative messages you received were due to deliberate neglect. Probably most were unintentional. You were afraid of the thunderstorm, but your parents didn't hear you cry because of the noise of the thunderstorm. Whose fault is it that you now don't trust your spouse to meet your needs when you feel vulnerable? You probably don't make that connection to childhood, of course. You don't know that this sense of distrust began long before you even met your spouse. I'm all alone, unworthy of being cared for, you believe. That's shame. It's easy to get judgmental about your parents and the misery you feel they caused you in childhood and extending into your adult life. But I want you to keep a few things in mind. First, most parents did their best. Certainly not all, but most. They had their trauma from childhood, which shaped and made them into the parents they were to you. Although I've indeed forgiven, I will not forget hearing from my mother, "Shame on you, Joe," when I had somehow messed up or disobeyed. I firmly believe that she intended to correct my errant behavior, not instill a sense of shame. The pain I saw in her eyes wasn't so much about what I had done, but came from some deeper place within her. I didn't understand that at the time, but later as an adult, it became more apparent when I spoke to her about her childhood. Her family was poor and living in Chicago, and she recalled being sent to bed early some days. Why? Her parents didn't have enough food to feed her and her siblings supper. And at one point, she shared a one-room apartment with her two brothers and parents. She recalled watching the family car repossessed with her father's only winter coat inside. She cried all day. And as her father struggled with alcoholism, her parents were sometimes unavailable to her. Despair. What messages did she interpret about her place in the world? That it was unsafe, uncaring, fragile, unforgiving, that she was undeserving? And how did those beliefs shape her parenting style? I don't think she wanted to share the shame she felt, but at times she projected what she felt about herself onto me. It wasn't intentional. It came out of her sense of shame. She also taught me invaluable and life-affirming lessons. She taught me compassion and love and faith. She gave me the gift of laughter. I could go on and speak about the good she gave me, but for now, our focus is on shame and maybe where you developed it. What were you taught about your feelings when you were told, "Big boys or girls don't cry"? Or told that you were spoiled because you wanted to go to Disneyland. You had to do the brown bag lunch when all your friends got to buy it. How much praise did your parents offer, fearful that you might become haughty? Maybe they withheld nurturing, wanting to teach you toughness. If you're not sure about what went into forming your parents' life, ask them about their childhood. Did they have enough to eat? How were they loved? How did their sense of shame get passed down to you? Now, up to this point, we've only explored how you may have inherited shame through unintentional acts. But what happens about those specific, harmful, traumatic acts? Were you sexually or physically abused or neglected? And now perhaps one part of you understands you weren't to blame. But your sensory memory, where you hold memories in your body with emotion and felt sense, tells you something different. One client of mine years ago was repeatedly and horribly abused, raped by a neighbor, not believed by her parents, and later told it was her fault, saying she was being sexually promiscuous. Her babysitter abused her. I mean, I could go on and on detailing the abuse. I won't. And although none of the abuse was her fault, period, decades later, she couldn't believe otherwise. After several suicide attempts and anxiety off the charts, her sense of shame was so profound that she couldn't accept a free 5-cent piece of candy from my office. Why? Shame. You might rightly say, "Well, that didn't happen to me, Joe, so why do I feel unworthy of love, of dignity, etc.?" Well, good question. Research supports the idea that the minor traumas, some of which I talked about earlier in this podcast, right? The minor things add up and can be more destructive to our sense of self than a single more prominent form of trauma. It's well known that childhood trauma can cause you to feel shame, but any mental health disorder that involves self-criticism or judgment can also cause it. Trying to live up to your perfectionistic standards can cause it. Because then every flaw tells you you're not enough. Public humiliation and bullying can cause shame. The list, unfortunately, seems endless. And so you begin to hide and withdraw from others. Yet the quality of our relationships most supports our mental health and a sense of, I'm enough. I'm lovable. But recovering from shame isn't just about feeling good. Shame can lead to addiction, depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation. It may cause compulsive or excessive behaviors like strict dieting or workaholism. It can lead to mistrust issues, making relationships nearly impossible. I could go on and on about the causes and fallout of shame. But more importantly, how do you recover from shame? The first step is identifying where your shame comes from and how it impacts your life. How and when is your shame triggered? Now, this is no easy process, but perhaps you begin to explore what you really believe about yourself. Do you think that you're evil, unlovable, don't matter, unforgivable, you don't belong? Do you have difficulty trusting? Can you connect? Now, I want to offer some practical solutions to heal from shame, but honestly, don't look for a quick fix. This is a mountain climb, not a walk around the block. This may be a process when you decide it might be best to get some help from a professional therapist. Shame may have begun because you were mistreated, but it will continue if you continue to mistreat yourself. In other words, you must start to have compassion for yourself. Remember Jesus' words, love others as you love yourself. It may be easier to begin by asking how you'd speak to a dear friend who had been abused. What words would you use with him? How would you talk to her? What would be your tone? How would you demonstrate compassion for their suffering? Meditate a moment on this. Got it? Now, this is how you must begin to speak to and treat yourself. Neuroscience research shows that, like other habits, the more you engage in specific thoughts and behaviors, the more likely they are to become automatic and pervasive. But here's the beautiful thing. Your thoughts are not a permanent fixture of your personality. They can change. You can grow. How and what you think and feel about yourself is not a constant. The term for this is plasticity. The saying you can't teach an old dog new tricks is simply wrong. God has called you to a life of growth and change. You don't have to stop learning once you graduate from college or you retire. While God gives you breath, you can change. This is the science. It isn't my opinion. Slow down. Listen. What is your inner dialogue? Remember the earlier example I gave when I challenged you with the question, is rejection painful? That was a couple of podcasts ago. The words you are speaking to yourself likely reinforce your self-worth. You are supporting the shame. Become aware of the dialogue without judging it. Remember the powerful story told in the Gospel of John, John chapter 8. And the woman caught in adultery. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery and made her stand in the middle. And they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What do you say?" And they said this to Jesus because they wanted to test him. They wanted to have some charge to bring against him. And Jesus bent down, and he began to write on the ground with his finger. But when they continued asking him, he straightened up, and he said to them, "Let the one among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he bent down and wrote on the ground. And in response, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. So he was left alone with the woman before him. Then Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She replied, "No one, sir." Then Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, do not sin." So a few thoughts about those passages. First, what happened to the dude? I am guessing that he was also captured if she was caught in the act. But she stood alone. She was put there in front of the crowd where her sin was publicly addressed. Shame. Second, what she did was wrong. But Jesus' focus was not on reinforcing the shame. He just wrote in the sand. His focus was on compassion, forgiveness, and change. Treat yourself similarly. Third, Jesus didn't get into the blame game. He didn't point out everyone else's sin, including her accusers. You do not have to react to other people, although this can be extraordinarily difficult when you feel you're being attacked. Instead, you must take responsibility for your reactions, your emotions, and your words. Blame rarely changes hearts, minds, or behavior. Stop blaming yourself and others. Blame is only going to serve to keep you stuck and feeling resentful. An interesting example of this in Scripture, Jesus is walking with his disciples when they see a blind man. And they don't ask Jesus to heal the man or provide him comfort. They ask him instead, whose fault is it was that he was born blind? Was it his parents or his sin? And Jesus pointed out that they were way off base. He responded by telling them to stop the blame game. Look instead for what God can do. He then healed the man. This is all told in John chapter 9. And fourth, and most important, Jesus did not condemn the woman caught in adultery, but instead offered forgiveness and a redo. "Go and sin no more," he said. It's time to allow yourself to experience forgiveness and the opportunity to experience new life. Stop beating yourself up. What do you want to let go of? How do you move forward? That negative self-talk that is just reinforcing that you're unlovable, that you're no good. Stop beating yourself up. You've got to cultivate an inner voice that offers you compassion. Love others as you love yourself. That's God's command. So what might this look like? As a therapist, I frequently use EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, to help people process trauma and hurt. You see, EMDR recognizes that the brain can constantly learn and take your experience and update it with current information. Why is this important? Well, as I mentioned, you internalize messages about yourself and your world throughout your lifetime. And those past emotionally charged experiences, those experiences that cause you shame and anxiety, etc., are charged. All those charged emotions interfere with your brain's updating process. You get stuck. You're emotionally reactive. You now respond to your life with all the emotional energy you felt when traumatized. It keeps you from thinking with the parts of your brain that are healthy and mature. Again, remember that I'm not necessarily referring to major traumas, but all the little messages that add up to your feeling of shame. So with EMDR, the therapist helps guide the client through rapid eye movement to help update those early disturbing memories, like what you do during your REM sleep. This sleep pattern allows you to process troubling events. An alternative to the eye movement is tapping. So after brief sets of eye movements or tapping, the therapist checks in with the client and asks what they notice. Although the process is more complicated than what I'm explaining here, EMDR efficiently and effectively allows the brain to update dysfunctional thinking and memory with more adaptive thoughts. So EMDR helps you to break through where you're stuck so you can enjoy the healthy life that you want. Now, if you're really stuck or highly reactive, I strongly suggest getting professional help, preferably from a trained therapist and EMDR. However, what are some practical steps if you're not in a place to do that? How can you allow your brain to update itself? Well, I think you might actually enjoy this process. What do you need? Well, maybe some comfortable outdoor shoes, access to the outdoors, the prettier the better, and an open mind, because you're going to take a walk. So your first question is, well, Joe, why do I have to get outside? Well, I could talk for hours, literally, about the research supporting nature's psychological and physical health benefits, but we're not going to go there right now. We're talking about shame. But just a few highlights. Research has shown that spending time in nature can improve memory, lower stress hormones and blood pressure, reduce feelings of depression and anxiety, enhance immune system functioning, increase self-esteem, help with self-control, improve working memory and cognitive flexibility, replenish mental resources, increase happiness, help the brain deal with eating disorders, positively affect mood disorders, buffer the effects of loneliness and isolation, help develop a sense of purpose and meaning in life, and finally, it's just sometimes fun to get dirty while playing outside. Oh, okay, the above is all based on research, except for the messy part. That's just me who enjoys that. But researchers actually are shown as well that just looking at pictures of nature and listening to its sounds has beneficial effects. But go for the real thing. Get outside. Okay, now that you're outside, and perhaps it'd be a good idea to have another warm body with you instead of the imaginary Joe Sikora, because what I'm going to ask you to do can cause distress. However, if you're with another person, you are not to check in with them about their memory of events that you may have shared. Why? Two primary reasons. One, memory is faulty, and everyone will remember things differently. And two, it is about your interpretation of what happened and how it affected you. Two people can share the same experience, like a movie, but walk away with an entirely different understanding. So now that you're moving your body in nature, go ahead and ask yourself what disturbing memories from childhood maybe are feeding your distress, your sense of shame. So is there an image that goes along with that memory? How disturbing is it? It might even be helpful to rate the disturbance of the memory on a scale of 1 to 10. Why? Because each time you do this exercise, you can rate your level of distress again. If you find that you're less distressed, then you're onto something. Now ask what negative beliefs you have about yourself because of that experience. Do you believe that what happened to you is your fault? That you're a terrible person? That you're unlovable, unworthy? Again, this is the tricky part of the exercise because a part of you might say, no, I'm lovable, or, but a deeper part of you doesn't quite believe in the good. So allow yourself to be honest. It might hurt, but remember what God says is you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. John chapter 8, verse 32. So as you continue to walk in process, notice how your brain begins to feed you with current, more adaptive information. You were a child. It wasn't your fault. Notice the evidence that you are lovable, good, safe. At this time, you can also allow yourself to reflect on God's messages of love. God created you in His image. He formed you in your mother's womb, Psalm 139. You are loved and God calls you His friend, John chapter 15. Allow yourself to feel good and believe in the good. Now go ahead and imagine future challenges, but now picture yourself dealing effectively with these challenges, not reacting negatively with shame or anger, but with love and calm and assurance. Baseball players or golfers don't mentally rehearse striking or hitting the ball into the pond, as I frequently do. They see themselves and rehearse success. Keep in mind that the early apostles, they blew it a lot, but they grew. God's love transformed their lives, and so can yours. The very same spirit that God gave them, he gives you now. You aren't meant to do this alone. You can't. But with God, all things are possible. Time to let go of the shame. I will meet you back on the road. And remember, always forward.